We welcome in our friend, author Colin Fleming. Hello there, Colin.
Hey, how's it going, Rich guy?
Going very well, thank you. I see you're back out there taking care of steps, monument or not. I mean, yes, you would like to be there, but if there's a crowd, you've got other ways to get those steps in and take care of what you need to do.
A lot of the contributing factors, Kimball, determined by crowds, the days of the week, how many stairs have always run, already ran. You know how it is. Gets complicated.
Well, absolutely. I wanted to, we've got a list of things we want to cover, but you had a wonderful piece on the blog yesterday, the best thing I've seen anybody write about the Bruins' ugly situation. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. This would be the Mitchell Miller saga. And you know what? I've discovered that a lot of times saying the best thing that anyone says about anything is really simple. It's just consolidating a lot of basic points. And that ends up coming across badly as profound, I've discovered. But you see how agenda-driven people are whenever they chime in on any subject. They're not interested in the facts or the truths or anything. So you hear these arguments, and people can go look up. I'm sure they know by now. They're listening to us what the whole deal was with this saga, as I term it. But they'll say, oh, who hasn't done something regrettable when they were 14 years old? And, of course, everyone has. But there's just such a huge difference between doing something regrettable and making a bad choice and maybe showing off for your friends that one time. I think we all have things that we look back on and we're horrified by the decision we made in the moment. But that's a lot different than something that's protracted and plays out over years. And I also think the whole idea of bullying is a form of torture for a child. It doesn't just have to be a child, but it's really akin to torture. It's making someone's life a kind of hell every day for most of the days of the year. Now, these days, that torture follows you home. You don't even have the respite at night with social media. So to bring this person in who clearly wasn't contrite based upon everything that was out there and documented stories, I think reflects a certain incompetence on the Bruins front office. And it was more disappointing to me, especially because Cam Neely was always one of my favorite players, precisely because he espoused an ethos of accountability on the ice. You remember that about him, right? He just was a guy who wouldn't take BS.
Right.
It wasn't like a policing goon type of thing. He had a code of moral conduct. He was the classic take a number sort of player, and eventually that was going to come around, and he was going to run a guy. He was going to run him fairly. It wasn't going to be a cheap shot or anything like that. He just played with a certain moral code that, to me, was more pronounced than any other hockey player I've ever seen, and I've seen a lot of hockey players. So for this to happen on his watch, it's almost like they were trying. I know they weren't, but like they were trying to screw up in the worst possible way that you could. And I'll always be a Bruins fan and all that, but I sort of separate these things. But it's very disappointing to me on many levels.
No, I agree with you completely. And a terrific piece yesterday. All right, let's talk a little classic radio first here and go back some 70 years to the Gunsmoke radio series and an episode called The Ride Back. Now, you describe this to me as a lost episode.
It is. It was heard, obviously, at the time. This is episode number 10, or 1952. But this, I'm sure you were very excited, wasn't heard by anyone, for the most part, until this year when it was discovered in some guy's collection, someone who had taped it right off the airwaves. So there are all of these Gunsmoke episodes. Hopefully we've gotten some people into Gunsmoke listening to these segments we've done about the show. But you have about 500 episodes to choose from. But this is one of the few that ever went missing. And it's a two-person episode for the most part. We get Chester Proudfoot at the very end. But Marshall Dillon is accompanying a prisoner back to Dodge. They're out on the trail for 3 days or however long it is, and they're paired up almost as a team. He's the prisoner, but these guys have a common problem. Cheyenne Indians back from a raiding party are trailing them and mounting attacks.
Yeah, and the attitude that Marshall Dillon and the prisoner have about those Indians is very different, and then the willingness to take up arms against them different as well.
Right, and the prisoner, of course, wants a gun, and we suspect that he wants the gun so he's not caught, tortured. There's like a torture theme underneath this episode that you're just not going to be killed by these people. It's going to be worse than that. And they take shelter in what turns out to be an abandoned cabin. Well, not really abandoned, but something heinous and horrible. And the evidence of that is within the cabin, has transpired there. And it's interesting to note that when the prisoner puts like his feet up on the bed, which is certainly not going to be used again, Marshall Dillon, he chastises him for that. And the guy says, like, logically, they're not going to be using it again. You've seen what I've seen when we came in here and all the bodies and everything. And Dillon says to him, if you don't understand, then you just don't understand. And I think that's the kind of, like, subtle point that is replete in these Gunsmoke scripts that makes the writing so tight. And there's going to be the prisoner, like, you really can't even begrudge him that his attitude that much with the Indian / Native Americans, because these were realities of the time. It's like The Searchers, for instance, that John Ford film, it's based on actual accounts. It's not like that was just invented out of thin air. So they definitely have different attitudes towards these bucks who are trailing them. But there's a surprise at the end of the story, and that puts me in mind of the close of Melville's Billy Budd, where Billy Budd says that famous line, God bless Captain Veer, and the men all on the ship, they repeat the line because they're so stunned that he said it at what is the moment of his execution, actually. This guy, the prisoner, does something that we don't expect him to do. And Dillon had alluded earlier to this notion that he has the screw loose. And there's something off about this guy. And there is. But that thing that's off about him, which we never know, and we tend to never know people who have that thing that's off about them. We can't, like, pinpoint it. But it ends up saving Dillon in this particular story.
And remarkable use again, and maybe the best that I've heard in the old time radio series, the use of sound effects. They are so much better in Gunsmoke than just about any other show you listen to.
I think that's true. I've just listened to, I've probably heard all 500, nearly 500 episodes by now. We're not in town for this episode, but I know the layout of Dodge because of the sounds that people make when they walk. I know how far it is, how many steps it is between one bar to another bar, how many stairs go up into a particular bar. It's not this in-your-face kind of approach to sound design. It's what you need to have in order to see in your mind what's happening. There are clever things, too. Like, you'll notice that Matt Dillon often wears spurs. He doesn't take them off. So we know, you see what I'm saying? We know when it's him walking
right. Rather
than somebody else. We don't need to be told. We're not telegraphed that exposition. That's the thing that's really brilliant about the sound effects here. The exposition largely comes through the sound design. So it seeps into us. It's like this osmosis. It's not like, you know how in suspense it can be so clunky sometimes where one character says, so you mean to say you just came in the room and took four steps? And it's over the top like that. And we don't have that at all with Gunsmoke.
We're talking with Colin Fleming on Downtown. From there, we move to Spoken Arts and an adaptation of Frankenstein from the early 70s. And I've been impressed with these Spoken Arts selections. They do a really solid job.
Yeah, that's the adjective I would use, too. I was just thinking that, because they're not going to wow you. And my sense with these broadcasts, which we can listen to because, like, some guy, you can read about it online, he was looking for them for, like, 30 years, and he finally found them. It sounded like the quest of his life, so that's why they're available at all. I think their utility was that they were educational that's what it was supposed to be. But it wasn't also, at the same time, supposed to bore you out of your mind. But any entertainment you got, really, was looked at as a bonus. And I think it's to the credit of how well-constructed these episodes are. We talked about the Dracula one. That you can listen to them. You can treat them as if they were classic old-time radio. So with Frankenstein, we get a fairly faithful adaptation of the Shelley novel, complete with, I think sometimes, like, people, they don't know this. The monster in the novel, and in this particular recording, is a very loquacious fellow. He has much to say. Like, he picks up the English language quickly, just by kind of peeping in a window, essentially. And then he's like, you will not shut me up. I have stuff to say, and I'm highly articulate, and listen to me go.
And so much of it also told from the perspective of Victor, which is not always the case in these adaptations.
And that's how it is. Imagine, like, it has the setup where there's the ship at sea, and there's, like, this giant guy, like, on an iceberg, and he's doing whatever he's doing. And then, like, a couple hours later, there's this other guy in this weird pursuit over the ice floes. It's such a great image from Mary Shelley. And Victor comes on board, and we're using the correct name. Now, people who are fans of the James Whale horror films will note that he's Henry Frankenstein there. There is a different Henry, to make it even more confusing. He's like BFF in the book, and he's referenced here in this particular recording. But it's sort of a deathbed confession that we get, there's the story, and the ship's captain is bearing witness to this. But again, it has all of these hallmarks of the book. It doesn't stray that far from it. Same with Dracula. Now, it's tight. It's not, the book kind of rambles in a way, because Mary Shelley wanted to put in all of this philosophy and ruminations on man's existence and what he should and shouldn't do and poke his nose in. So we don't get a lot of the digression, but we do get that core story, and it really doesn't veer too far from what she wrote in the novel.
I enjoyed watching a season one episode of Newhart, and it was interesting to watch the episode called Shall We Gather by the River before a friend of the show, Julia Duffy, joined as Stephanie. And it might have even been before friend of the show, Bill Sanderson, and his brothers, Larry, Daryl, and Daryl showed up, which really took the show in a different direction.
No, they're there. We've already had them on the show. They're not regulars at this point. They hadn't really. But they're there from, this is from the first season, November 15th, 1982. Maybe a guy like you watched this back in the day.
Oh, I'm sure I did.
Girls and girls. Yeah, so it's more likely you saw it. But it's seasonally appropriate. Well, maybe the weather hasn't quite been what we get in this episode of Newhart. But the three woodsmen don't show up in this. But I like the small town tradition. The type of episode I watch, and I hope things like this still happen in this cesspool age of Instagram and Twitter and Facebook and everything. And what that tradition is here is the first time of the year or of the season, because obviously it happened earlier in the year, that the river, the local river, has frozen over. And everyone goes to the aptly named, as Kurt says, river party. You get your skates. You roast some hot dogs. The whole town gathers at the river. And Mary Fram, Bob Newhart's wife in this show, she doesn't want to do that. And he kind of, here I can score some points. He mansplains. And you're going to come. You're my woman folk. And he doesn't really say that. But he doesn't ask her if she wants to go. He answers for both of them because he is the man of the Stratford Inn. And she goes, and she falls through the ice, and it's a bad time, and he tries to make it up for her with some hot romance, and that backfires. But I really just like the idea of, we're off to the river. Don't you want to do that? And we're out there, and like I say, hey, Kimball, keep your head up, and then I pop you. I mean, that would be awesome, right?
Yeah, there is that sense of community. And then even after Joanna is embarrassed, much of that community shows up to try and make her feel okay about it, but Dick kind of screws that up again.
He does. He's hapless in this. Nothing is going the way that, in the end, he sort of does, with an assist from Leslie, who was the Stephanie kind of figure before Stephanie. She was the... am I even allowed to say this? She was the maid. That's what she is on the show. I don't know what the term is. I don't keep up with these things. But she was the maid at the inn, and she also studied like medieval history and theology at nearby Dartmouth. But I don't know. I hope things like that continue on, where people do. I feel like they don't, because if they did, I would just be looking at photos of it each time that I logged on to social media, because there's no way someone would just let something be an organic experience. We can't have that. But I don't know. I'm as New England as the granite underfoot, Kimball. So it's something that has immense appeal to me, because it's obviously not something that happens in South Carolina, but I also don't think it's something that happens in Wisconsin. It's like pure New England.
Also like the fact that there's a little passion, a little fire there in the Loudons' relationship.
Yeah, there is. But it's like at the beginning, when she's like, you know what I want to do tonight? I have some pretty good ideas. I'm thinking, oh my goodness, I don't need to be all the images this is conjuring up. And I don't know. Yeah, he's like, he's raring to go throughout, but he's saying this with everyone, the principals, like George, putting logs into the fire. He's like, oh, I have a romantic night. He's like, I could get in on that. And I mean, what do you expect to happen? There's supposed to be a time when he's like, okay, we're having romance. Like, you'll have to leave the front room of the inn and the warm fire and the cocoa and everything. So, yeah, I don't know. This first season, it's worth pointing out, and I don't think like people tend to know this because they talk about the last episode or whatever. The first season of Newhart is a completely different show than all the other seasons.
Right.
It's much less broad. Like, if you had a marathon and you went from the first season to the second season, still have Kirk, but then to the third season, it becomes like surrealism. It becomes increasingly surreal. And this is not surrealism. This is naturalism. This is New England naturalism. You know what these episodes, the early episodes of the first season, remind me of? It's like going to a play. And you don't get that later on. You're looking at kind of a flamboyant, broad, surreal, weird TV show. This is New England Americana weird, but not outright comedy weird.
Yeah, and I wonder if part of that too is that Newhart had a tendency to replace writers on a pretty regular basis, and I wonder if that contributed to taking the show in that new direction.
It changed so much. And another show that did is like Frasier. In the moment, it gets confusing, because when Frasier becomes a completely different show is when Daphne and Niles pair up. And when you say that, people think, you're saying that because there went that tension. No, there must have been a shift in the writers. It's all verbal wordplay early on. Smart wordplay, crisp, Joycean. That's not what it is later. It's like frumpy and broad. And if you liked it for its intelligence early on, how incisive the wit was, you don't get that later. It's just more sort of standard American sitcom after. So I really like that first episode of Newhart. And simultaneously, you had the first series of Cheers, where it was also going to be somewhat different than it was later on. The entire first season is set in the bar, and the bar of Cheers is much like the inn of Newhart.
All right, we're going to move to the world of music, and an English post-punk band, ACR, A Certain Ratio, and a piece called Winter Hill.
Kimball, did you not dance around the room to this and get your inner Zulu on? That's what I was picturing.
I kind of dozed off. I found it a little monotonous.
Yeah, I always sort of feel like music is a weak part of your game. But that's okay. Maybe give it another chance sometime.
Well, I have taste, and here's the nice thing about music. It's a very subjective thing. I didn't like it. I didn't find it entertaining. It was awful. I did not care for it. Tell me why I should like it.
Music is subjective, so Bach might not be that good.
It's not a question of good. It's a question of what moves you and what people like.
Oh, that's preference. I feel like that's different than subjectivity.
Yeah, I'm not saying it's not good. I'm just saying that it didn't speak to me, Rich Kimble.
I see. So for people out there, I know Joe Mason likes a certain ratio. This is 1981. It's after the demise of Joy Division. The ascent of New Order is happening. And there had never really been a fusion like this in all of rock and roll, where you got post-punk, funk, and dance music being fused together. Now, there are going to be major stylistic advancements that happen later on. For instance, Stone Roses is Fool's Gold. But I don't think the Roses make Fool's Gold at the end of the 1980s if they're not listening to their fellow Mancunians a certain ratio with this particular song. It's an instrumental called Winter Hill. And it's this intensely polyphonic rendering in time signatures that rock bands just hadn't played in. It's live, it's limber, it's really unlike anything that this band had ever recorded themselves. And so this song goes into the clubs, and it's so influential for people who knew what was happening here that for the first time, really, within the rock and roll medium, we have hardcore guitar music being paired with intense dance music. That's going to lead to a whole lot of other things, not just in England, but in the States with Prince. So this is really a seminal sort of innovation that was happening with this band.
I like melody. That's me. I'm a pop music guy. I'm a pop guy. I like country. I like folk. Yeah, well, it's okay.
It's intensely melodic and rhythmic, though.
It was rhythmic, I'll give you that. The melody eluded me on that one, but it's okay. I'm not saying it's not great. It's certainly influential. It just didn't do anything for me, and that's okay.
Yeah, I hear you.
What did do something for me is the video you shared of Walter Johnson. Man, oh man, what a find that was.
Yeah, it's like 4 or 5 minutes long of composited Walter Johnson pitching footage from 100 years ago now. And you get to see it's always interesting. Like, you can watch video of Babe Ruth hitting, sort of wonder, or Lou Gehrig also taking batting practice, the one after another. And it's just batting practice, but it's all we have to see what their style was, their technique, how they move their hips or whatnot. So this is the pitching version with Walter Johnson. With Walter Johnson, you have, I don't know, he's probably the best pitcher of all time. I mean, he's in the top four. I think he's in the top two. And I think people who know baseball would pick him as the best that there's ever been on the mound. And so he was throwing, a lot of these guys, they were just throwing fastballs. When I say a lot of these guys, I mean like Lefty Grove, he's a bit after Walter Johnson, but Lefty Grove was throwing nothing but a fastball till the end of his career with the Red Sox because he could just get by on speed. And that's what Walter Johnson was doing. And it's different with Walter Johnson. You can more readily understand how he was able to do that. The balls, for instance, they were scuffed and could kill you and you couldn't see them and the sun was going down. But then there is his delivery. And the delivery just makes it look like he was a bad time to try and hit against. He was throwing this whiplash version of sidearm where his arm is coming from way behind him to pop out at you, have at you at the last second. The ball must have been on you so quickly. And you can see it's almost sort of like Randy Johnson with that delivery, but it looks more frightening to me.
And when you see some of the early video of pitchers, a lot of times you would see the exaggerated windup. And with Johnson, there's very little windup. I'd seen in the past video of him pitching that I assumed was just him warming up. But even the game footage, it looks like he's just out there effortlessly throwing that thing at about, 98 miles an hour with no leg drive, none of that we've come to think of as a power pitcher look.
crazy windups last for a while. Warren Spahn, Juan Marichal, they had windups that definitely seemed exaggerated and difficult to replicate. Johnson is not working under much duress, and there's an irony in that because when we see pitchers throw underhand or sidearm, you think about like Kenta Colvey in the 70s and 80s, it looks like it would be painful, and he seems to be having the easiest time. It's just this coil of a body designed, was the Phelps, the swimmer, where he has like the giant feet and the giant hands. It's like he's designed to be amphibious and in the pool and doing what he does. Walter Johnson in this video, he looks like someone who was designed to pitch and rack up 400 plus wins and be the best pitcher of all time. And he got by largely with this. It wasn't his only pitch. He had a curveball too. But so much of what he did must have been that delivery.
And it had me thinking about what it must have felt like to see this guy for the first time as he made his way off the farm and showed up and just began to throw that thing with blazing speed.
Yeah, and you wonder now if that would be coached out of him at some point. I feel like there was a lot more openness to what we could call idiosyncratic approaches to throwing the ball at the time. And I think pitchers can do more of that than batters can. You can have more stylistic variability. A hitter, for instance, if you have a giant hitch in your swing, and that's part of what you do to like get yourself going, you're not going to get to the league, or if you do, you're going to be out of the league, that type of thing. Whereas a pitcher, prior to releasing the ball, can pretty much do whatever they want so long as they're on that rubber. So I think of like a young person coming up and facing him for the first time. That must have just sucked. It was going to be a bad day. And he pitched on some teams too, where they were almost like the 1960s Dodgers of their day, where there wasn't a lot of offense. And Walter Johnson was expected to go out there and give up one run or less. And he usually did. So it's really just time capsule stuff that, I think it's fascinating for people who like baseball history or people who just like baseball, period.
Numbers we'll never see again. 531 complete games in his career and 110 shutouts.
I don't know, though. Numbers we'll never see again. What about in 8,000 years from now? You know what I mean? Though, when people say that, they're usually basing that on how things have gone over 100 years. Like, we don't know, bionic people. Like, we have no idea. Maybe something like, there have always been times in sports history, and the country hasn't been around that long, so North American sports history, where people say we'll never see numbers like that again. And probably, I don't know, like Phil Esposito, or when players started having 100 points, like the NHL had been around for a long time, and finally someone like cracked 100 points. And then Gretzky is getting 215 points. So who knows? Humans have been around for thousands and thousands of years in sports. So I don't know, but we're not going to see it in the next like 10 years.
Right. But, numbers we won't see in my lifetime because I've only got, you know, at best another 40 or 50 left.
Well, you don't know. I mean, you know what I mean? No, you don't know. You don't know what might happen. It's like the people who, this is a bit different, but people say you only go around once. I was writing this in a piece of this. Like, you don't know that. How do you know that? Who told you that? I mean, who knows? Maybe you and I are back again from someplace we were before. Maybe you and I hoisted some Guinness at a Manchester club in the late 70s, and you said to me, "This band, A Certain Ratio, blows my astute music mind." I said, "Piffle, Kimball, I am bored." And we had a row. You don't know, but we're back.
I'm so glad we've made it across that parallel universe to find each other again.
Yeah, so coming full circle on your AM dial, Bangor.
That's what makes life an adventure. Colin Fleming, every week here on Downtown. Thank you, Colin. We'll do it again next week.
All right, sounds good.